Welcome back to the Foreign Desk. I'm Lisa Daftari. Lots of news to cover today, and to unpack it all, we call upon my good friend and colleague and mentor, Dr. James S. Robbins, who is the Dean of Academics at the Institute of World Politics. He's a senior fellow at the National Security National Security Affairs at the American Foreign Policy Council. He holds a PhD from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and he has taught at many different institutions, including the National Defense University, the Marine Corps University, among many others. He's also served as Special Assistant in the Office of Secretary of Defense, and in 2007 awarded the Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff Civilian Service Award. And he's also an award-winning senior editorial writer at the Washington Times, columnist for USA Today. I don't know where he has time to do all of this. And also a prolific writer. He is the author of 5 books, which I will tag below so that you can get those at your convenience. I highly recommend all of them because he is really a wonderful expert, very unique perspective that you offer, Dr. Robbins. I want to welcome you to the show, and it's a pleasure to have you here, somebody who really understands foreign policy in an academic realm, but also can apply it and understand it and really give us a true perspective of what we're dealing with today in terms of current events.
Well, Lisa, thank you for that very generous introduction, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Robbins, you know, I used to start out this show asking everyone what their academic assessment, what grade they would give our current foreign policy, how our administration is doing. And I stopped doing that because, well, it's pretty relevant, and I just didn't want to keep repeating the same segment over and over again. But since you actually are a dean, I think we should bring back the tradition of giving our foreign policy a letter grade. So what's your assessment and what kind of metrics are you using?
That's a good question. I would gravitate towards a gentleman's C the Biden administration. I think that's kind of like an average, because I think on some things they're doing okay, and on some things they're just completely not doing well at all. So it's in the middle. There's a mix of good and bad, but overall not so great.
Not so great. I think one of the things, and you and I have spoken about this in the past, and it's really no surprise to anybody in terms of the criticisms, is deterrence in the places where we're not doing okay. Is it, too little too late? Meaning, will our enemies even take us seriously if we try to, put our foot down and try to, draw some sort of boundary? I mean, I guess the bigger question is it a coincidence that over the last 3 years, we saw Russia go into Ukraine, we see Iran's regime, flexing its muscles every which way. We see obviously China lining up its assets and, putting its players in the right places. Would these incidents take place and escalate the way that they did, regardless of who was the leader of the free world? Or are we seeing this as a result and as a consequence of the type of leadership we're seeing in terms of our foreign policy?
I would say it's definitely more towards the latter, that it's a result, that the revisionist powers of the world are starting to take advantage of the fact that the United States is exhibiting a weaker leadership than usual, in terms of the, over the decades. And the question of Ukraine, for example, would Putin have invaded if Donald Trump was president? Well, I mean, he didn't invade when Trump was president. After our failure in Afghanistan in 2021 with the fiasco of our withdrawal, that was almost like a signal to different world leaders that, hey, maybe the United States isn't really up to par right now with its leadership. Maybe they could take advantage of it. And so I think that and other sort of maybe more symbolic displays of weakness, like the Chinese spy balloon fiasco that made us look kind of stupid, things like this have shown the revisionist powers that if they want to make a move, now is a good time to do it.
Now, is that kind of weakness, the brand of weakness that has come from the White House, is that easy to reverse, if they would even want to reverse it in the next, how many months do we have left?
Well, in some respects, yes. I think particularly maybe tactically, you can reverse it. For example, when the Iranian proxies hit our, you know, Tower 22 in Jordan, and the response to that, because we had been suffering these little like pinprick attacks, you know, hundreds of them from different proxies, not really doing anything or having proportional response. But then in response to that one, where Americans were actually killed, I think the Biden administration did that pretty well. I mean, number one, they took out the leader of the group that mounted the attack. That was good because it shows, number one, that we knew who it was and that we could reach out and touch him. Number two, aside from hitting all these targets, it was how they did it, not just with, you know, drones or cruise missiles or something, but they sent over some B-1s, some B-1 bombers to conduct part of this attack. And that was a signal to Iran because, you know, B-1 doesn't have to stop. They can just keep going,
right?
You know, bomb targets inside Iran. And so after that, there were reports that the IRGC was telling some of its militia groups to kind of lay off for a while. So I think that at least temporarily, the right. Biden administration was able to send a signal that, you know, you can mess with us some, but don't mess with us too much, or you may get a response.
Well, in the follow-up to that, are we continuing to just play whack-a-mole, or was the message sent loud and clear? Because if Iran's regime is the one saying, back off a bit, you know, escalate a bit, back off a bit, aren't they the ones who are in control? Aren't they the ones calling the shots? Doesn't that signal further weakness on the part of, doesn't that put the United States in a more vulnerable position?
Well, yes. And you can see this in Iran's response elsewhere, because whereas they might have told some of their proxies to lay low for a while, they certainly haven't done that with the Houthis,
right?
Who right. have ramped up what they're doing.
Absolutely.
And yeah, you know, that's a good example of right. where we have not deterred them, where we mm-hmm. don't have escalation dominance, because we, the United States, have stated we don't want a wider war. We're not going to target your leadership. We're only going to target weapon systems that actually threaten us and things of this nature. Right. And that gets into the question of, can you have proportional response and deterrence at the same time? And the answer is no.
Right. You know, it's interesting. That was actually, you segued perfectly into my next question, which was specifically to talk about the Houthis and the fact that they're just playing pinball with the various carriers and ships that are going from, you know, Western assets that are going through. They're both public and private. And it seems like obviously the deterrence isn't working. And I actually came to frame this question and I saw that you had already beaten me to it with a national interest piece that you wrote in January called Deterring the Houthis Won't Be So Simple. And you wrote, Western leaders should threaten the Houthis with more vigorous and deadly retaliatory action should they continue their campaign against regional shipping. If the Houthis believe in, quote, death to America, the least we can do is return the sentiment.
Right. And well, A, the administration has not done that. And B, the Houthis, you know, keep escalating because they really, I mean, they don't care. If we're right. not threatening them in a way that's meaningful to them, which is like threatening their leadership or, you know, it's yeah. like taking them out, then they're not going to stop. And why should they? All we do is these proportional responses. They attack us a little bit, we attack them a little bit. Well, that gives them the initiative and it gives them the impetus to continue to escalate to try to find where exactly is our red line. And they haven't found that yet. So now, there, well, two significant things recently. Number one, they actually sank a ship, you know, a cargo vessel, but they actually sank it. It was the first time. I mean, they've damaged some things, but this was the first actual sinking. And so that gets them excited. And the second thing is that the U.S. Navy destroyed a sort of underwater drone that they were using to attempt to attack our vessels. And this tells me that they're learning from the experience of the Ukrainians in attacking the Russian fleet, the Black Sea Fleet, where the Ukrainians have done a magnificent job in damaging and sinking. They have 24 ships damaged or sunk of the Russian Navy. And strategically pushing them back in the Black Sea So, and this is, you know, Ukraine doesn't have a navy to speak of, but they've used these unconventional tactics extremely successfully against a superior naval force. Well, the Houthis are probably watching that very closely, not to mention their Iranian sponsors. Mm-hmm. And so the United States is no doubt going to increasingly see these kinds of unconventional attacks against us. And if we, you know, if we don't deter them, and imagine the propaganda victory, if it wasn't a cargo vessel that they sank, but a U.S. warship. I mean, just imagine that. And so if we can't deter them, or if we don't deter them, we're asking them to keep trying.
And speaking of keep trying, let's look at the broader picture with Iran's regime really playing puppeteer here in so many different ways. And I know the United States has done whatever it can to kind of separate these two incidents. So the Houthis are one off, and what's going on between all of Iran's proxies, including, of course, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah against Israel, is a separate war that the White House tries to micromanage from Washington, D.C. Obviously all connected, obviously all puppeteered by the same regime. You know, you don't see, I mean, how can we deal with this in a way that is meaningful, that both deters our enemies and protects our ally, Israel? And again, this would be assuming that the White House would want to move forward with that narrative versus the one that we've been basically straddling for the last 6 months.
Right. And not just Israel, but other friendly states in the region that are losing confidence in the United States as a guarantor of their security. So the White House has gone out of its way and explicitly to say that none of these things are connected. When we know that they're connected, through Iran. They just don't want to say it, because I think that there are people in the administration who hold out this kind of vain hope of a rapprochement or some kind of outreach, or, you know, some kind of deal with Iran that's going to make everything go nice. And that's just not going to happen. So from a strategic point of view, it would make a lot more sense to put more focus on Iran, because they're the ones who are energizing this system, who are getting their proxies to, you know, do things on their behalf, to attack us, to attack our friends and allies. And until the administration comes up with a strategic framework that at least acknowledges that truth, we're not going to make any progress at all. Iran doesn't want a rapprochement with us. All they want is their frozen money. I mean, that's really what they want, is the billions of dollars of money that's been frozen. But meanwhile, their policy is death to America and death to Israel.
Right.
So recognizing that alone would be a wonderful first step.
But why haven't these, what I call inconvenient truths about Iran's regime, changed the positioning? I mean, you touched upon something so interesting, and that's the ideology of this current administration. And we saw something much similar and spearheaded by the Obama administration, where they believe the same thing, that this normalization with Iran's regime would be the unicorn of foreign policy. It would make everything lovely and dandy in the region and across the world. And as you outlined, it's obviously not true. These are foreign, we would like to assume, these are foreign policy professionals. Why hasn't the truth, meaning whatever Iran continues to do, obviously they, you know, they're not playing nice with the IAEA inspectors. They've turned off 27 or 30 cameras in terms of surveillance. The centrifuges keep spinning. The enrichment of uranium keeps increasing. We thought it was $60 billion that they sold in terms of their own revenue. Now, last night, news broke that it was $90 billion. That was a Free Beacon piece that came out. Why haven't these truths, these facts, change the position of that ideology, that narrative, that agenda, that major goal of still wanting to normalize relations? I still have not gotten a good answer about why this administration and their predecessor, the Obama administration, want this so badly.
Well, it's strange. There are people in the administration, and you know, by the way, some of them are the same people in both administrations, who have this sort of predisposition to want to make nice with Iran. And it's odd that you have so many progressives who want to make nice with Iran when the Iranian government is certainly not in line with their ideological worldview. you know, not in line with how they would like to see a society. So I find that strange. I mean, the common coin seems to be that they both don't like Israel so much. I don't know if that's what's driving it. Mm-hmm. But it is unusual because there's nothing about the Iranian regime with its, you know, poor human rights record, oppression of women, oppression of, homosexuals, gay people, and other alternate lifestyle people, oppression of minorities, oppression of everybody who doesn't agree with the regime, you know, this theological totalitarian regime, that doesn't really fit the progressive worldview. Mm-hmm. So why are they so dead set on trying to normalize relations with a country that represents everything that they hate? And I just don't understand that.
Right. And it goes side by side, another perfect segue into what we're seeing in terms of support for Hamas and what's going on between Israel and Gaza, right? We see it all throughout social media, TikTok, Instagram, and of course in the White House, in mainstream media outlets, on college campuses, on the streets of DC and Montreal and everywhere else, London, Los Angeles, New York. Something I want to get your thoughts on is, of course, we see this kind of very much not in line with progressive ideals. Of course, we know all of that. But it seems as though since the international court said, well, it's not genocide, even though South Africa is dead set on that, it's not genocide. Now it seems like the academic world, the analysts, the media has moved on to this word proportionality, meaning, fine, if you don't want to call it genocide, which we still think it is, and of course TikTok will maintain that, it's not proportional. Could you define the role that the word proportionality or proportional plays in this current conflict between Israel and Hamas?
Well, people use the word in a variety of ways that, of course, it's rooted in just war doctrine, where people say that the, you know, wars have to have proportionality to be just. But in that respect, it really refers to things like war aims and the intensity of war and the collateral damage of war that's effect on noncombatants. In that respect, it doesn't mean that you have to lose a war. It doesn't mean that you can't, you know, fight it to the end. Certainly, Hamas's war aims with respect to Israel are total. They want to destroy the state of Israel. And we know that. They say that and they admit it. So it's perfectly reasonable and proportional for Israel to destroy Hamas. That's parity. They both have the same war aim. But the way that the word is being used now in terms of Israel's war fighting is to say that any of the civilian deaths that have been taking place are laid at Israel's feet, that they're fighting, you know, if not genocidal, but still a war that is overly damaging to the people of Gaza. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's true. I think Israel has done everything it can in very difficult, complex urban terrain to fight this war. I mean, when you think about what they're up against with the tunnel system that's three times the length of the Washington, D.C. metro system, and all of the different things that the Hamas fighters are doing. In this urban environment, it's very difficult to fight a war in that environment and to do it without destroying a lot of things. I think Israel has been very good at what they've been trying to do, trying to get people out of harm's way. I mean, we know that Hamas have been the ones preventing people from moving out of harm's way, because at the end of the day, the people of Gaza are their human shield, them and the Israeli hostages that they hold. But my response to the proportionality or the people saying genocide is the suffering could end today if Hamas would simply surrender, because they are the ones that are keeping this thing going. The Israelis would be happy to take their surrender and it would just end all of this. And we know that in the end, Hamas is going to lose. It's not even a question. I mean, they're going to lose. It's just a question of how many Israelis and how many Palestinians they will take with them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's refreshing to hear you say that as a professor, as a dean, as somebody who's in academia. This is not what we are hearing. Interestingly, I'm going to go off topic just for a moment, but it's actually, we'll bring it back to topic. I was actually at the LACMA this past weekend and they had an exhibit on the Great War and global media, meaning connecting just war propaganda and things like that. And I actually just thought about that right now in terms of how pivotal the role of propaganda is in this current conflict. What are some of the consequences, or what is the long-lasting damage that this propaganda has had and will continue to have on this current conflict?
Well, I think propaganda in general embeds facts, or, you know, things that aren't facts, but it embeds ideas into history that may not be accurate. Certainly the image of Israel that Hamas would like to portray, and Hamas sympathizers, of them being, disproportionate, genocidal, colonizers who are conquering and all this other jazz. That's a negative, because there will be people throughout the world who believe that. They'll see it on TV, they'll see it in propaganda outlets, and they'll believe it. They'll believe any outlandish claims of Israel killing civilians wantonly, you know, like the recent food riot over aid, where Israelis were trying to ward it off by firing over people's heads. And suddenly, and I've seen it stated in Western media, Israel killed 100 people. No, they didn't kill 100 people. It was a tragedy that happened, that where Israeli troops were standing by and actually trying to prevent it, but they couldn't. So just things like that. And, you know, throughout history, you've seen misrepresentations of things by interested parties on one side or the other, and they get embedded in the overall narrative. Right. So maybe not every outlandish story will be believed, but enough of them will be believed that will kind of leave sort of an aftertaste of whatever happens here, however it ends. Israel will not be the winner in terms of the propaganda war amongst large segments of the global population.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting because if you connect this to all the other propaganda wars that we see going on right now in terms of just penetration into our various sectors here, whether it's in our universities, in our labs, government, our interns, right, whoever's coming over the border, and a real effort where, you know, a lot of Americans are not paying attention and, you know, so deeply embedded in their own echo chambers, whether it's on social media or in academia or, you know, dinner table conversations. We would be remiss to have this conversation and not touch upon the head of the dragon or snake or octopus or fill in your favorite animal, Iran's regime. So this, what we talked about in terms of deterrence, in terms of propaganda wars, you know, obviously all being held by the remote control, being held by Iran's regime, and it continues. They will continue doing whatever it is that they're doing, and they have succeeded. Donald Trump, for a short while, had some success in what he called his pressure campaign, right? It wasn't a call for regime change. It wasn't anything too revolutionary, but it was, you know, to get some sort of behavioral change, or at least curb the regime to a certain place, which I believe, you know, what we just saw in the streets of Iran for a year in terms of the woman life freedom movement was an absolute result of that. You know, the people feeling they have the confidence or have the regime in a vulnerable place to go out onto the streets. What we're seeing right now, that about face on that Iran policy in terms of removing the sanctions, taking the Houthis off the list, looking the other way in terms of human rights, giving them lofty positions at the UN, you know, letting them move forward and earn all that oil money, sell weapons to Russia and other trade partners. How will this ever, I mean, will it take more than the next administration to reverse these policies? How damning is what we're seeing right now in terms of Iran's regime, in terms of its goals for regional hegemony? I mean, how deep are we into this, and what will it take to reverse that?
Well, I think strong leadership is always useful. I mean, it can always reverse things. It would be helpful if we had stated strategic goals. We don't seem to. The current administration seems to kind of flounder around with respect to Iran. What are we actually trying to achieve with respect to Iran? It's not clear. So number one, clarity in our objectives would be extremely useful. And then consistency with whatever our stated objectives are, like, Reagan-style foreign policy where you say, you know, it's the evil empire and we want to see it taken down. Okay, well, with respect to Iran, let's be clear. They are a totalitarian regime. We don't like them. We would like to see regime change. We're not going to make regime change probably, but if the Iranian people want to rise up, we're fully in support of that. I mean, give the people who inside Iran dislike the regime the hope that that they can change things and the United States and other Western countries would look favorably on that. I mean, give them a little encouragement. And I think that, would go a long way towards changing both the perceptions of the regime towards the United States, that, we're a little tougher than they think, but also of the people inside Iran who, frankly, are tired of living under this theocratic regime mm-hmm. that has restricted their rights, restricted their opportunities, ruined their economy, and, given them a bad life. So let's talk about something aspirational for the Iranian people. And look towards a future in which we don't have to deal with a regime, this type of regime, because it won't be there.
It's interesting where we are in all of this, because we see so much of this escalation right now. And usually sane people talk about de-escalation, right? In terms of foreign policy, we don't want this to turn into something bigger, regardless of which conflict we're talking about. But we have to also add in the context of this being an election year here in the United States. How do you see that factoring into all of these different escalations? Do you see our current crises developing into more escalations, fewer escalations, more entanglements, fewer entanglements? How do you see this going this year?
Well, probably fewer entanglements. And unfortunately, President Biden is in a tough situation because, number one, all the polls show a close race. Some show, him behind, some show him ahead. But in any case, it's going to be close, presumably, if things go as projected. So that means he has to keep his party together. And the people most objecting to his foreign policy right now are the progressives. They're the people who are saying, maybe we won't vote. They won't vote for Trump, surely, but they're not going to, they just won't turn out. Right. And that's where he's seeing a lot of dissension. So that has forced the president to do these like symbolic things to try to placate them, whether it's calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza or this airdrop of aid, which looked good on TV, but it's like the most expensive, least practical way to send humanitarian aid is by airdrop. You only do it if it's an emergency.
Right.
And, bringing Benny Gantz to Washington to yell at him in the White House, like, how dare Israel not do what we're trying to tell you to do? Have a Ramadan ceasefire, like these kind of symbolic things. Because in fact, the United States is not going to abandon Israel. The United States isn't going to make it so that Israel can't win this war or do anything unilateral. But the president has to edge towards these things to placate the progressives. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the problem for the president is the progressives understand that these are only symbolic and they're playing to win. They don't like Israel either. And so they want to see substantive things from the White House. And every time he makes a symbolic gesture to them, they just ask for more because they understand that if he's showing weakness to them, which he is, they can keep demanding things and getting more. And as the election year progresses, this is going to get more intense. So he will have to do more and more things to hold his coalition together. And it may actually start to have a tangible influence on our foreign policy.
It's very, very interesting. We'll be watching it all. And of course, we will call you back, Dr. Robbins, to give us your expertise. Thank you so much for being here with us. Follow his writings, buy his books. I will tag all of that below. And thank you so much for joining us. We hope to have you back here very, very soon.
Oh, thank you, Lisa. I'll be back anytime.
Thank you. For those of you who'd like to subscribe to our weekly podcast, go to youtube.com/LisaDaftari. And to subscribe to our daily top 10 headlines, go to foreigndesknews.com.